be as much of a, I'm going to bug them as much as I can so they know how inconvenient this is.
So that red light will show up in the new room at the LIO? Is that that okay?
What's that?
When I press the red light here, that shows up in the new room?
No, they don't see that.
So really, it's only for the people in the room? Mm-hmm.
It's for audio stream that they're doing.
Oh, we cut the audio stream. Oh, we cut the audio stream.
So they're, I mean, technically they should all be muted and anchored until they're ready to go. Oh, go ahead,
turn off the red light?
Yep.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. I'd like to call this meeting to order. Today is Monday, October 30th, 2017. The time is 1:30 p.m. Members present today, Co-Chairman Hoffman, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Emhoff.
Good afternoon.
Senator Stephen. Good afternoon. Thank you for all of those joining us today online, off-net, and in the room here at the Anchorage LIO in Anchorage. We will be joined shortly by Senator Olson. I'm co-chairman Anna McKinnon. And on today's agenda, we will be hearing from Paul Decker, our petroleum geologist from the Department of Natural Resources, Ed King, the special assistant from the Department of Natural Resources, to talk about our fall forecast projections. After that, we'll hear from Commissioner Sheldon Fisher, Department of Revenue, and Dan Stickler from the Tax Division. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite Paul Decker to the microphone. And again, for those listening, the purpose is to understand our gap and to identify that gap from the administration's perspective, to understand the DNR's forecast for revenue that is coming in from our oil producing area. Please, Mr. Decker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for the record, my name is Paul Decker, and as you said, I'm a petroleum geologist and the Director of the Resource Evaluation Section at the Division of Oil and Gas. And
your microphone is working. I would like to acknowledge Senator Giesel is in the audience joining us today. I don't see other legislators at this time, but please continue. Mr. King.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the microphone, I'm just testing the microphone. Anything here?
Trying to look at the back. back of the room. Can folks hear a little bit better? Thank you.
Madam Chair, we're here today to present to you the preliminary numbers for the fall forecast, production forecast, which feeds into the Department of Revenue's revenue forecast. So I'd like to start the presentation with a, now that we have the official numbers from fiscal year 17, we can now officially say that we have seen the last 2 years of consecutive production increases. That fiscal year 17 production number is still preliminary. It might change a little bit between now and when the revenue sources book actually gets published, but we're somewhere in that ballpark, looking at about a 9,000 barrels per day increase in production in fiscal year 17 over 16, which amounts to roughly 3 million extra barrels of oil over the previous year. Our preliminary numbers looking forward, with the 4 months of data that we have so far in this fiscal year, are indicating that we're on pace to beat last year's production numbers as well. Would be the third consecutive year of production increases. The dashed line that you're seeing on this slide, Madam Chair, is our forecast, our 12-month forecast, based on the monthly numbers that we have for projections right now. And the red dots that you're seeing on this slide, Madam Chair, are preliminary numbers for the production that has already occurred in this fiscal year. And what you can see is that the actual production numbers so far are tracking our forecast relatively well, indicating that we are, in fact, looking at about 533 or so thousand barrels per day for fiscal year 18, another 9,000 barrel per day increase over the previous year. So far in these 4 months that we have actual data on and preliminary numbers, we're looking at about 4,000 barrels per day in increased production over the previous fiscal year, and we're expecting the producers to continue to beat the last year's production from the majority of the winter months as well.
Yeah, you know what? I will keep an eye on the slides for you.
Madam Chair, the increases that we've seen in the last two fiscal years, I've broken out for you here by unit, indicating where those additional volumes of oil are coming from. And what you're seeing on the right half of the screen is 2 years ago, fiscal year 16, the increase that we saw, that 14,000 or so barrels of oil per day, 13 or 14,000 barrels of increased production in 16 over 15. And you can see that Colville River unit contributed about half of that increase, and the Prudhoe Bay unit contributed about the other half of that increase in production. The rest of the units were relatively flat. Nikaichek was still doing some drill out, so they had some increase in production as well, but the majority came from those two units. The Colville River or the Alpine Field, that majority of that increase can be attributed to the CD5, the development that is occurring currently. That's continuing to drill out currently, that started in 2015. And the other half in Prudhoe Bay, we can really only attribute to improved operator efficiency.
I'm doing it right now.
Last fiscal year 17 over 16, we've seen increases again throughout many of the fields, again at Prudhoe Bay, from increased production through operator efficiencies, and continue drill out at CD5. And then on the right, you see a Gorek had an increase as well. That is largely in part due to the fracture stimulation success that they've seen at the Gorek field. But what's really impressive, Madam Chair, is not just the increases year over year, but the increases over what that production would have looked like if that trend, that downward trend that history provided would have indicated. And so what I've done here is compared the actual production numbers against what the production would have been if that 5% decline that we had anticipated would have continued. And what you can see is that the production across the entire North Slope is really impressive. The producers have beat their production and the long-term trend production by not just a little bit, but by very impressive margins. And that's especially true, again, at CE5 in the Colville River and at Prudhoe Bay. That 20, almost 28,000 barrels per day of additional production at Prudhoe Bay, that's the equivalent of bringing a new field, like a Nikaichek-sized field online. So it's very impressive and very good news for Alaska. Moving on, Madam Chair, the 10-year forecast. This is a representation of what our forecast looks like. We'll have the actual numbers for you when they print in the revenue sources book in December. So you're seeing here is the on the far left, the solid lines and dots are the actual production numbers, and you can see the increase year-over-year production. And then moving to the right, the dashed line is the mean case forecast that we're estimating. And then the dotted lines above and below are the range of potential outcomes that we see as feasible. Do you have a question? I'm sorry.
Mr. King, thank you so much. I just wanted to let those that are listening online know that this document is available online. And if you could refer to the page number as we switch between lines so that folks can follow that might not be in the room, that would be helpful. So right now we are on a document called Preliminary 2017 Fall Production Forecast, dated October 30th, 2017, and we're on slide 6. Thank
it's
you.
It's on paper.
My apologies, Manager. The fall forecast from last year I've also put onto the slide just as a comparison so that we can look at how our forecast has changed in the last 12 months. So the triangles that you're seeing below the forecast that we're looking at is what we were forecasting to happen when we were here last fall. And that forecast was based on the 2016 numbers. So we started doing the forecast in August of 2017, which is the 16 for that fiscal year that we presented last year. And these were the results based on that data. And then when we came in this year, we started again in August after the fiscal year ended and we had the official numbers. We incorporated that 12 months of data into our analysis, and what came out is the forecast that you're looking at now. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if you could speak to that forecast. I'm not real familiar with it, but is this a little mistake, a terrible mistake, a reasonable mistake? It's wrong. Why is that?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, there was definitely a change in the forecast, and that change in the forecast is largely a product of the change in the information that we have now versus what we had a year ago. So when we are looking at the forecast, and if I can move to the next slide, I can speak to that just a little bit more. I'm on my slide 7 now talking about the lessons learned and why the forecast changed, Senator Stevens, through the chair. When we were doing the forecast last year, 12 months ago, we were at a time where oil prices had just fallen by about 50%. And all of the news that you would read in the papers were talking about rigs being laid down and about global contraction of the oil industry and how they were the entire oil industry, including the partners that participate here, were pulling back on capital. We actually did see that here in Alaska as well, where the companies were pulling back on capital. And given the information that we had, even though we did have 1 year of production increases, given all of the indications that we were seeing and incorporating all of that data into the forecast, we weren't very optimistic about the ability for the producers to increase production at a time when they were reducing capital expenditures and pulling back on investment. So our forecast reflected that sentiment. Now that we have that additional 12 months of data where the operators have shown us they can, in fact, find ways to increase efficiencies and produce oil in a price environment that we were a little pessimistic about, we've adjusted our sentiment accordingly. And Madam Chair, the forecast that we put together was pessimistic, even relating to, I'm sorry, I moved on to slide number 8. And on slide number 8, what we're looking at is 3 bars, and on the left, the blue bar is the forecast that the state put together. The red bar is the forecast that the operators combined and aggregated put together and provided to the Department of Revenue. And then the other bar, which looks gray on the screen, is what the actual production numbers turned out to be. And what you can see is the actual production not only beat our forecast, but it beat the producer's forecast as well. And it really just speaks to how impressive the operators on the North Slope have been able to operate on behalf of Alaskans and do such great work in a time when we were really pessimistic about their ability to do so. And for fiscal year 2018, now what we're seeing is that our forecast is slightly higher than what the forecast that the operators provided to the revenue department are. So we're a little bit optimistic now that the producers are, in fact, going to be able to continue to operate very well and to continue to find ways to find efficiencies. And, Madam Chair, if there are no questions for me, I will now turn it over to Mr. Decker. Thank you, Mr. King.
No, I'm sorry about that.
Okay, I'll just lean in on this other microphone. So I was going to speak to some of the changes in the methodology that we applied this year relative to last year. And for the record, this is Paul Deckard, Division of Oil and Gas. So really starting with slide number 10, some of the changes from last year's forecasting effort to this year. For the most part, our forecasting methodology really hasn't changed that much. We kept most aspects of the process very similar to last year's process. So both times we've generated a 10-year official forecast. Last year we took an approach where we entertained potential future developments that may be coming into the picture with sustained production within a 5-year window. And things that we thought were not going to hit it within that 5-year window were excluded from our official forecast and really handled separately. You may remember us speaking of the term pot of gold. We felt like those things that were more than 5 years out were just so speculative and uncertain that we handled them in a sort of separate offline manner.
Mr. Decker, thank you for pausing. If you could, brief it is.
Okay, so
we're back on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this year, one of the other changes that we did, or one of the changes that we did, was include all of the projects that we think might make it into the 10-year forecast on a risk-weighted basis. And so that's been an important change, and you'll see some of the results of that graphically here in a moment. Last year, we calculated an annualized rate that was basically sort of a straight line looking forecast without showing the seasonal fluctuations that we know are a huge month-to-month swing in North Slope operations in particular. So this year we did calculate monthly rates, and we've adjusted those with what we call our seasonality trending or seasonality adjustment, and you'll see that showing up in the forecast as well. Last year, we emphasized improving long-term predictions. We kind of were focused as a team on the rather severe over-prediction in the out years of previous forecasts, and we felt it necessary to take steps to reduce that overestimation, you know, that we were seeing years out into the future. This year, we've realized, I think, from last year, just really what intense scrutiny there is on the first year or two of the forecast and how important that is to you as one of our major stakeholders and clients to understand the near-term production outlook. So we have taken steps to improve the prediction quality in the near term while trying not to lose sight of the tendency historically towards over-predicting in the long term. So we're trying to achieve we have our focus on both ends of the sites, so to speak. Last year, our under-evaluation projects, and I'll define that in just a moment, but the long-term projects were not risked for their chance of occurrence. They were essentially either on or off. This year, we have applied risking for those long-term under-evaluation projects, both for their chance of occurrence within the 10-year window, as well as the production rate that they would achieve if they do come on, and also for the timing of first production from those projects that are still in the future. And I see a question, so I'll pause.
Thank you, Mr. Decker. Senator Bishop.
Thanks. Mr. Decker, when your
matrix for your project evaluation. Is that public information? Is that something you can share with the Finance Committee? Through the Chair, Senator Bishop, I'm just trying to make sure I understand what you're thinking of, the matrix for which categories and under evaluation projects risked for chance of occurrence. We can certainly give you that. Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Mr. Decker, can you tell me on the forecast model that you're using on production, both near-term and long-term, if that's consistent with other regions that are similar to ours? So this is a very different look at production, and we saw that in last year's forecast also. And so I've been here for a few years where we saw some consistency in how we reviewed this, and now we're seeing some movement to improve accuracy. It's not meant to be a derogatory note, but we are seeing changes. So as we're shifting to try to provide a better understanding of short term, have we looked at other regions that are similar to ours to know if this is how they are handling production, or is this just something that we're doing internally to try to shore up our numbers?
Madam Chair, the letter is more accurate to say we have really tried to develop our process internally without any particular sort of off-the-shelf solutions available to us for other jurisdictions. I'm not sure how they do it, but we feel like the approach that we've taken is fundamentally sound in that we're trying to incorporate the uncertainties and the risks involved and develop everything in a probabilistic manner that can be addressed through a Monte Carlo simulation style sampling of the uncertainties for each variable. I think that is essentially an industry standard, if you will, that approach to risk and uncertainty. But as far as the details of how other jurisdictions might produce their forecast, I cannot say that we understand that or have knowledge of that. Certainly. So moving on to slide 11, sort of just on the heels of what we were just saying, this is only our second time through this process at the Division of Oil and Gas, as you know. Prior to that, the forecast for production was being generated by a consultant hired directly by the Department of Revenue. So we've introduced a number of changes there. And again, we're learning as we go, but we feel that we've made significant improvements to this year's forecast relative to last year's, just by implementing some relatively small changes, but the same overall process. So there's a lot of words on this page about increasing the understanding and the communication amongst the team members, amongst the software developer that we work with to help develop our quantitative probabilistic decline numbers for the existing pools. We did a look back at some of the previous forecasts and asked ourselves the question, how did the selection of the historic decline period impact? What was the sensitivity of that on the actual decline projections going forward? And we're glad we did that. We made some minor adjustments there that helped emphasize the near-term history as really the best predictor of the near-term future, which, again, is increasingly important to us. So we've taken those steps to improve the near-term accuracy and improve the collaboration, the communication with, I think, our stakeholders. Hopefully our communication with you is smoother this year as well.
Mr. Decker, does that mean, just to restate the obvious, that when you looked back, as you tried to apply the new formula so that we could see if it would perform in the same way, and then going forward, that we've, in looking in the rearview mirror, we've sort of tested this premise that going forward we could expect similar results?
Madam Chair, that is correct. That's something we generally call hindcasting or a look-back technique. And it's a way of testing the sensitivity of the model to exactly which portion of history one chooses to decline or to emphasize in the decline to get the best prediction of, you know, future production.
Senator von Imhoff. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question that I have is, I saw the other slide you had operator forecast, and I thought that was interesting that
we had sort of the three forecasts. You have your forecast, the operator, then an actual. What I've heard in the past is sometimes the part of your job that's difficult is getting comprehensive and accurate information from the operator so you can make as accurate a forecast as possible. Some of the information is proprietary. They may not want to provide that for any number of reasons. Do you feel that, number one, you're getting sufficient information? And number two, why not just go with the operator forecast then? Why go through the trouble?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, Senator von Imhoff, I do feel that this year we're, you know, getting the kind of information that we've requested, and that we're happy with the results of that information sharing. I still feel like without incorporating uncertainty and developing our own methodology, we wouldn't have anything more than a single back of the envelope estimate, which is, you know, the producer's total rolled up number. I feel that it's very important for us to include our own understanding of the range of uncertainty in any number of projects. The other thing is that I feel that some of the information provided by certain operators is very precise and likely very accurate. Other operators may not have possibly quite as accurate a take on how they're going to perform in the future. So I think it's a good idea to maintain our independence, but it is an interesting comparison to look at, certainly.
Mr. King, did you have a comment?
For the record, Ed King, Senator von Imhoff, your chair, just to add on to what Mr. Decker was saying, the operators do provide their own estimates, and of course they have much more information about their own reservoirs than we do, and they have the techniques and the software and the expertise to do those things very well. What we have a challenge with as the Department of Natural Resources is we need to aggregate all of these different operators' information across the entire North Slope and provide you with an estimate for the purposes of revenue. And those operators might not have consistent methods that they're applying to their own fields. There's also the case that production that's not already in production, the developments that are under development right now, those operators will apply different risking methodologies and have different assumptions about when their production is going to come online and how much risk that is associated with that production, what that volume looks like. So we have our own team that's able to take the information that we get from AOGCC is actual production data, and the information that we get from the producers about the reservoirs and what the actual resources look like, we're able to apply a consistent method across the entire North Slope. And when we come up with our forecast and we compare it to the producers, it does give some credibility to our numbers, I think, if it comes in pretty close to theirs. If there's big disparities, then, of course, we want to investigate that a little bit further, and we'll call the operators and ask for that explanation. That's a process that we go through with Department of Revenue usually in September while we're following up those questions. So I do think it is, it's possible Department of Revenue could just take the numbers that the operators get them for the existing fields and for, next year's forecast. Maybe that works. If you're interested in 5 or 10 years from now, I don't know that that would work quite as well.
Thank you, Mr. King. And again, to restate the obvious, the reason that we're having these background hearings about our production and the revenue forecast coming up is because in the past, oil and gas production revenue has been up to 90-95% of the revenue coming in to the state of Alaska. So it dramatically impacts the conversation about the fiscal situation that we find ourselves in and how we recover and how we include oil and gas as part of that recovery. We certainly have been a topic of multiple bills in front of us before. So we are here to understand in the future what revenue we have available to us for conversation, how that revenue is trending, how that production is trending, and hopefully establish at least a parameter on the gap that we face in this upcoming legislative special session and on into January when we look at our budget for the following year. So, again, just to restate the obvious, I would like to add Senator Olson was coming in from Golovin. Senator Olson, thank you for joining us. He was delayed because of weather and had contacted me earlier today that he was on a different flight out than had been previously anticipated, so we appreciate you joining us. And Senator Michicki, I'm sure, is following us online at home. He is ill. He assures me that it is the first time in 12 years that he's been this under the weather, and so I wish him speedy recovery, so it's no fun being sick. But everyone is following and paying attention, but this is why two of our members were delayed in getting here, and one I'm sure is following from a bedside TV. Mr. Decker, please continue.
Certainly, and if I may just add one other point to respond to Senator Von Imhoff's question. It occurred to me as I was speaking that another reason that we like to do our own forecasts is because using public data, if we generate a forecast for an individual pool, we can show that forecast. However, if the operator were to provide that information on a pool-by-pool basis, that would be taxpayer confidential information that we may or may not be able to share, depending on their sentiments. So this way we can develop our own by-pool estimate and share those. So moving on, I guess I'm on slide 12 here. So I think we're reiterating a couple of points, but our decline curve analysis has been weighted towards the recent production history, really projecting forward based heavily on the last 2 to 5 years of history. Another change that we introduced this year is to create a probabilistic range, a high-low sort of range within which we believe the actual production will fall at least 80% of the time. We introduced that from day one of the forecast. So that's a slight difference in the near-term outlook. And another really important thing that we did this year was we have given essentially full credit to the planned under-development production. Under-development meaning those wells that are expected to yield production within the first year, 12 months of the forecast. Previously, last year, we had a philosophy that essentially discounted most of the underdevelopment production as within the background that shows up in the decline curve analysis projections. And really, over a very long term, that may be a more accurate way to go, but for the short-term prediction, it's really important to focus on the activity that is happening in the fields during the first year or two of the forecast. It does have very significant impact on that near term. So that's a significant change in the way we treat a DUV tranche. Moving on, the next slide is methodology. So here I'll define some of these terms we've been using a little bit loosely. First, these three categories that you see in the three main bullets. Currently producing, that's really all of the production coming from the fields.
Slide 13?
Yes, I'm sorry. Slide 13. Thank you, ma'am. Currently producing is the production coming from the currently producing fields, and it's, as I said, analyzed by itself to develop one category of the forecast. Projects under development, or UD, that stands for those projects that are expected to yield production within the first 12 months of the forecast. And essentially what we can think of as really what's in their plan of development that the operator has told us they would be doing this year. And so that's very important to the near-term forecast, near-term future. And then the under-evaluation category or tranche are those things that are expected to yield production from 2 to 10 years out. So years 2 through 10 of the forecast. Both the UD and UE tranches are considered in terms of financial risk. We model them as either occurring or not, depending on whether their break-even price and expected revenue makes sense to do that. And we use type wells to build up the production profile for both UD and UE. So type wells, one can think of that as essentially a generic well. It's actually a probabilistic range of performance. If you drill a well and you add one of these type wells, and it's either a mean case or somewhere in between the low case P90 estimate or the high case P10 estimate, but you build up a profile based on a number of type wells, depending on how many wells are expected in the project. And the other thing for the under-evaluation is the chance of occurrence during the 10-year forecast and the project timing risk. So given that it happens during that time period, what year do we feel that it will be, that it will actually yield production? And there's some uncertainty in both of those, and the timing is actually a very important variable. So moving on to slides after 14, this is really the forecast results for our fall 2017 forecast. This is what I would call the money shot, the big roll-up slide. What we're looking at here is the entire 10-year official forecast, and we've tacked on at the left in the black solid line, we've tacked on about 3.5 years of recent history, and then the dark blue line going forward to the right is our mean forecast. So that's our best estimate. And we have the whiskers at each month there, the high and low range of what we call our P90 on the low case and the P10 on the high case. So 80% of the time, we would expect to be within that limit of error, somewhere between the whisker bars. And if you look at those whiskers, you see that the error range increases in the out years of the forecast, greater uncertainty as you work out into those future projects that have not yet come online or even achieved project sanction. So this is what I think of as a much more believable and intuitive product than we were able to show you last year, in part because of the seasonal adjustment that's been applied. As you see there, it makes that sawtooth pattern. That reflects wintertime efficiencies. Compressors, compression system works better in the winter on the North Slope. And it also reflects the summertime downtime, or, you know, TAR events, turnaround maintenance events that we see. So if you look at the junction there at the current moment between, or at the beginning of this fiscal year, between history and the forecast, in my view, this is a relatively seamless and believable forecast moving forward this way. Good news is it looks like it increases in the next year in the mean case, and then holds relatively steady in the mean case out through the 10 years of the forecast with not a huge amount of decline. So that's very welcome news in terms of TAPS longevity and things like that. Now, this is the forecast taking away the seasonal adjustments, just showing single point estimates through the years, but monthly, but not seasonally adjusted. And here we've broken the forecast into the three categories. The dark blue at the bottom is sort of our base management. Those are our existing pools that are, yes, they are declining, but they're declining at a certain rate. And then the orange band is the underdevelopment activity and the impact that it has, especially in the first year of production, fading into the out years of production. And then the sort of light tan or gray band at the top represents our underdevelopment tranche or category of production. Those are the new projects coming on more than 2 years out, up to 10 years out. So that's where we'll see things like, if I move on to the next, well, it'll be in a moment, but you'll see some of the new projects that we've heard so much about. Slide 17 is the currently producing.
If we could go back one slide.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We were on slide 16 during that conversation. Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Decker, if you could just clarify, you said the tan slide?
Did I see the tan layer? Okay, it's just sort of a gray or tan layer at the top of the chart.
You called that
the underdevelopment category.
And down at the bottom it says UE.
I'm sorry, did I say underdevelopment?
No, that
should be under evaluation. My mistake. Yes.
Thank you.
Beg your pardon on that. So if there are no further questions on that, but it's very important. It shows that the bulk of the forecast still comes from the currently producing fields, but important near-term impacts from the underdevelopment tranche and very important long-term contributions from the under-evaluation category. Thank you for the clarification. Moving on, now we're looking at just the individual pools or fields contributions to the currently producing forecast. And I guess Ed made this slide. He rolled it up at the unit level. You see that the dark blue layer at the bottom represents the Prudhoe unit. The orange just above that is the Kaparik River field, and just above that is the Culver River unit. So those three are the workhorses in our currently producing fields, and quite a few additional thinner bands above those. So you can see that if we were to stop investing right now today, stop maintaining and replacing existing wells as they break and things like that, yes, the pools would continue declining. It's not as if we've reached a point in their history when pools somehow magically sustain themselves. On page 17. Thank you, ma'am. But the good news is that the decline in the currently producing forecast is being largely mitigated in the long term and the near term by the underdevelopment and underevaluation categories.
Thank you, Mr. Decker. Senator Hoffman.
We had heard that we were going to expect great things from Point Thompson, and this graph shows a steady line. I wonder if you might speak to that issue.
Certainly, through the chair, Senator Hoffman. Point Thompson was hoped to come on at about 10,000 barrels of condensate per day. We know that they did have some operational problems getting started and getting that production online. It's my understanding that within the last few months, a few weeks possibly, it's come on at a fairly high and relatively steadier rate than it has been at. I don't believe they're at the 10,000 barrels of condensate per day mark. This is a very different project than the other, the Point Thompson expansion that would go along with a major gas sales, which would yield far more condensate in addition to the gas. That's a different project entirely. This is just, I believe it's a three-well gas cycling project, sort of a pilot project that they call the Initial Production System, IPS. So it's improved, but it appears that it's still not quite at the level that Exxon and others had hoped.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question that I have is, do we anticipate any improvements in technology and heavy oil?
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, we do have in the long-term forecast, you know, the under-evaluation tranche, we do have one category for an UGNU heavy oil development. But the reality, as you'll see on that slide, is that it's not likely, unless we see something really different happening with price, that we would see that technology applied to a large-scale project that would result in our 10-year forecast looking different than it does.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Senator Hoffman. Other questions from committee members?
If we can just move on to slide 18. So this is a diagram showing in the 10-year forecast period what do the under-evaluation, the long-term projects look like. And this is all the under-evaluation projects, again, risked for the chance that they even occur, that they produce first oil in the 10-year window. And then also risk for the timing, the uncertainty of what year that oil starts, and then the uncertainty as to how they would perform, any one project, how many barrels a day it might make. And so when you take all those three uncertainties and you convolve them, you roll them together, this is a roll-up that you should really probably think of not as a single prediction for any one pool or field, but think of it as a stock portfolio, if you will, where what we're trying to arrive at is the best estimate of how the entire portfolio of new opportunities might perform over time, taking all those risks and uncertainties into account. So please don't view any one of these projects magnitude in isolation as our best estimate of what that project would look like if it occurs. Right? This is not that sort of a discrete scenario on a field-by-field basis. This is our best estimate of how the entire portfolio might perform over the forecast period. So moving on from slide 18, I believe Ed has a couple of comments to make as we wrap this up and then field your questions.
Madam Chair, for the record, Ed King, unless there's questions on this slide, I think it speaks for itself, and I will defer to your questions or to Department of Revenue to continue the conversation.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Hoffman. Mr. King, I have one question. It's off topic, so you can provide me the answer later, but We had quite a bit of seismic data that was presented to us last year in huge quantities. Are we starting to work our way through that data to understand if we've received anything of value?
Madam Chair, yes. The tax credit seismic data program is one that my section in the Division of Oil and Gas Resource Evaluation has a lot of responsibility for. And we have over, you know, I guess the first tax credits were implemented in, I believe, 2003 that had to do with this kind of data submission process. And the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've been very busy working on ensuring that the data as it comes in meets our expectations. We are now in the data release stage, or at least we're poised to release more data. We released a little bit of data last year, and now we have recently received the go-ahead through a regs package to go ahead and distribute more data with the caveat that we can charge enough to maintain some administrative control over the costs, you know, recoup some of our administering costs. So we will be releasing more data here in the next few months, and we expect that operators are going to be very interested in obtaining that information and using it to develop exploration prospects, in particular for lease sales.
This next question may not be fair, and if you can't answer it, please just say so, but have we paid for the tax credits associated with the data that we're getting ready to release?
Yeah, that question, Madam Chair, would be best addressed to Department of Revenue since it is really their program.
I warned you it might not be fair. Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Thank you. Well, this is quite interesting. You said earlier that you were no longer using consultants. Can you talk about that a little bit? You're not using consultants. You're doing this in-house. How many people does that take, and are you satisfied with the numbers you have?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes. We have a pretty small group, really, working on this, spending a lot of time on it. It's, I believe we have a commercial analyst. We have two reservoir engineers this year. We have two geologists, myself included. And others from the Division of Oil and Gas, especially within the commercial section, will weigh in at times and provide some information that's important for us to use. But it is a relatively small group spending a lot of time. I think the product that we're able to come up with now after our second iteration on this project is considerably better than what we provided last year, and I have to take ownership of that, I think, within our group, you know, that we were somewhat naive as to how the product would be used and scrutinized and some of the particular needs of you in particular as a stakeholder, but also the Department of Revenue as another client and stakeholder. So I do feel like we're making real significant improvements this year, and I hope that the rest of the forecast team feels the same way. I believe that we're pretty proud of this product this year. Did I answer your question? Okay, right. As far as whether a consultant could do a better job, potentially they could do a better job, but I had not seen in previous projects conducted by the consultants, we had not seen the sort of probabilistic handling of uncertainty. And I really think that is an industry standard technology or technique. It's not a technology, but technique that is the best way to go. I think it's only fair to have quantitative sideboards on any estimate, especially something this important.
I would like to thank you for coming and sharing this information today. It is important to all Alaskans. I know that Alaskans understand how important the oil and gas industry is to our state and how much of our budget in the past has been provided from taxing through a variety of means the oil and gas industry, and that there are two sides to that. There is the production side, so I thank you very much. As I understand it, I saw a warning, so I just like to give that warning to those that are listening. These numbers are subject to change. The Senate asked the department to come forward early, as well as the Department of Revenue, and provide us numbers in a compressed time so that we could use those for our evaluation as we move into the special session. So I just want Alaskans and the committee to remember that these numbers are subject to change as the departments and the divisions go back in and refine the products that they've been working on. And so we may see something different when we hit December and the budget cycle as the governor moves forward. But I do appreciate Senator Hoffman and I met with an administrative team and made this request from the to the Commissioner of Revenue. And so we do understand that this is sooner than is normally done, so it might not have all of the bugs, per se, worked out of the process. So thank you so much for joining us today. With that, we'll take a brief at ease while we change out speakers and presentations. Brief at ease. we're back on the record. If you're joining us off-net or online, it's still Monday, October 30th, 2017. The Senate Finance Committee is meeting in the Anchorage LIO on the second floor. The next presentation is from the Department of Revenue. And again, to restate the purpose, understanding the revenue that is potentially coming into Alaska is very important as we go into conversations where there is taxes that are being proposed both on the people of Alaska and on businesses throughout our state. These are important discussions. The Senate is looking for a range, not necessarily a definitive number, to understand the gap in potential revenue coming into the state. As all Alaskans know, revenue from the oil and gas industry has been up to 90 to 95% of the undesignated general fund revenue to our state. So it's a huge player as we look forward. In the past 4 years, specifically oil and gas tax legislation has been before our bodies to the tune of $1 to $2 billion worth of extraction from industry and credits that have been removed to increase production from many's perspective. The combination of production and price is what has provided in the past a significant portion of Alaska's revenue, again, undesignated general fund. And the Senate, at the request, or the request to the Commissioner of Revenue, Mr. Fisher, has asked for price and production numbers prior to the deadline of introducing the budget, as we've seen those introductions before. And so, again, for Alaskans who might be listening, these numbers are but we do appreciate and thank the administration for providing at least a glimpse at where we're going and how we are trending in response to price and production. Commissioner Fisher.
Thank you. It's pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to present. I'm here with Ann Stickle, who is our chief economist with our economic research group, and I will start and talk about a number of topics, go through a number of topics, and then he'll pick it up and continue the discussion. Moving to slide two, I wanted to put this forecast into a little bit of perspective. Historically, the department has issued a forecast in the fall, in December timeframe generally, and then again, they update that forecast in the spring. In this current year, there's been a couple of things that have changed. The spring forecast that we came out with in April, I think fairly quickly both the department and the legislature felt like that forecast was too pessimistic. It, in essence, predicted that oil was going to decline too rapidly. And so in late April, that early April, we issued a spring forecast. In late April, we revised that forecast upward and actually reduced the rate at which oil, we predicted that oil would decline. We call it an alternative scenario. It wasn't really a revised forecast. It was an alternative scenario that we offered for consideration. That alternative scenario has become the foundation for most of the discussion in the last 6 months, both with OMB and Ledge Finance. They've used that. And so we may talk a little bit about how this forecast varies from the official forecast, which is one that I think many in the press were aware of, and then this alternative scenario, which is one I think we've been using internally, and we'll go into a little bit more detail as we move forward. This then is this October preliminary fall forecast is again another unusual step, but as the chair has referenced, because of the nature of this special session, in addition to the Senate's request, we felt like this was critical that people have the most current information that we can offer. And we will issue our fall forecast and revenue and sources book in December. And then, of course, in the ordinary course, we'll have another revised forecast in the spring. Moving to slide three, the chair has already mentioned that this is preliminary. I just want to note that the department had about 3 days between when they received the production forecast from the Department of Natural Resources and when they finished their work. work, and that was really at my insistence. I felt like we had to do that, and so there's no question that there's going to be some revisions and changes, and I own those. I demanded that we move on that kind of accelerated time frame, but I think this is very helpful and provides a framework for discussion, and our estimate is that in any given year, we would not expect to see the revenue change by more than $100 million. I know that's a big number and a meaningful number. As a percentage, it's actually relatively modest. Moving to slide four then, in terms of how we prepare the forecast, we directly predict the petroleum revenue. As has been mentioned historically, that's been a large percentage of the state's unrestricted general funds. In fiscal years 18 and 19, it's expected to be in the neighborhood of 70%. We also directly predict the directly forecast the non-petroleum revenue. We rely on the permanent fund and the Treasury Division for investment revenue forecasts. And then we use the federal revenue that's authorized as a forecast of our federal revenue. I think many that have participated know that typically we actually don't spend all of the federal money that we might have in the budget, but for consistency purposes, we use the revenue that just the federal government authorizes for spending. Moving then to slide six. As we think about the petroleum forecast, which, as I mentioned a moment ago, is 70% roughly of the overall undesignated general funds, there's production, and you've just had a presentation on production, and so I've got a couple of slides, but I'll move very quickly through that. Then there's the price forecast, and just to kind of give a preview, we have, compared to the prior forecast, we have moderated our expectations in the future. Not for the current fiscal year, but for future years, we are expecting that the price for oil will moderate. We'll then talk about the costs that are deducted, and ultimately the credit. So moving then to slide eight, I think many people have seen this. This is a pictorial description or representation of oil. We're sitting here in the forecast period represented by the dotted line at the present, and you do see in terms of the existing fields, they do continue to decline, although, and we'll give you a little bit more detail around this, they're declining at a slower rate than we might have predicted in the past, and then you see a sliver of pink off to the right, which represents new fields coming online, which in the scheme of things are modest, but as has already been mentioned, provide a lift to the decline that otherwise would happen and help stabilize our revenue substantially during this period. Slide nine, you've seen this, so I won't spend but a moment just to note that there's a range of possibilities. The high case, or the P10 case, is intended to represent the likelihood that there's a 10% likelihood that the price will be that price or higher. The 90% case represents that there's a 90% likelihood that production will be that level or higher. And then the official case represents a 50% likelihood. Slide 10, we can pause just for a moment here because this is some numbers that are consistent and underlie the charts that you saw in the DNR presentation. But just to highlight, this first of all is the North Slope only. It does not include Cook Inlet. If there's an interest, we can provide that. But Cook Inlet is a smaller percentage, and there was less change from the prior forecast, so we thought it useful to provide the North Slope numbers. What you see here then in this year in 18, we're forecasting a little over 530,000 barrels a day. You see that kind of declines modestly year over year, until you get out to kind of 2024, where it actually either increases or is flat through that period. And again, that represents a nice leveling off of production compared to what we had thought even just a year ago. Then moving on to slide 11, this then gives a sense of the difference. And so the orange line at the bottom of the page, and if I didn't reference, I'm on page 11, the orange line on the bottom of the page was that official spring forecast that we came out in early April. And what you see there, and we'll have a little bit more detail towards the end of the presentation, was a fairly steep decline in the first year of about 12%, and then a kind of more leveling off of that over the time period. The gray line represents that alternative scenario we described, where we did not have that steep 12% decline. We assumed rather a 4% decline, and so you sometimes hear that referred to as the 4% scenario. And then it more or less paralleled the spring forecast downward. The heavy blue line then represents the forecast that DNR has presented today. And it's obvious, but it's worth noting that as you go out in time, the difference is greater. And that's why when you start to see some of the data in our forecast, you'll see that in the out years, there's a greater impact associated with this new forecast. Moving to slide 12, then, it's just a recognition and provides a little bit of detail that over time, or as we come into this period, a portion of the revenue comes from NPRA, and, of course, the state has a different kind of benefit from those oil from that region. It is still a benefit. We don't get the state royalty, although we get a share of the federal royalty, and we do receive some production tax and corporate income tax and property tax. Moving then to slide 13 to 14, I'm going to talk a little bit about the price. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we have gone through our fall pricing exercise, and there's been a moderating of the expectations in the out years. On slide 14, we show a representation of other benchmarks that are used worldwide. The WTI refers to the West Texas Intermediate. That refers to the price for oil in the Texan Basin primarily. And then the Brent is more of a worldwide pricing, and that we have tended to price more favorably, although there's quite a wide range in the numbers here. Just in the last, since January of 15 through September of 17, the Alaska North Slope price against the West Texas has varied by a $1.35 discount to almost a $5.40 premium. There's been not quite as wide a range, but a similar range against the Brent. And so there's a number of factors that tend to drive it, but you can see that they generally move together. One of the interesting let me take one more slide. This is a more smaller, narrow period of time and goes from June of 16 through October of 17, and there you can see that there's been less variability in the price, and you can see the average price just under $49 or just under $50. One of the interesting questions that I would expect participants to ask, we saw, I think, on Friday, the Brent price for oil closed over $60, and that is actually a meaningfully higher than what we predicted. We start our day with actually a futures forecast where we look at kind of what the future markets predict that oil will be in 6 and 12 and 18 months, and we kind of in midday or towards the end of the day we get the prior day close and an analysis around that. And You know, I guess I'll show you more detail around this, but even though pricing in the current market is above $60, if you look at the futures market, it's more in the $54 range, which is actually what we've predicted for the coming year. And I think you'll see as we go through our pricing that it is very consistent in the immediate few years with other pricing forecasts. And this is something, candidly, between now and December that if there's a dramatic movement in the world markets, we may choose to revisit that. The department has revisited that in that time frame when there's been dramatic issues. But at this time, I feel pretty comfortable with the forecast that we have. Underlying the forecast, any forecast is, and I've moved to slide 16, it's really a matter of supply and demand and the inventories that result from that. And you can see here that there's been a narrowing of the difference between supply and demand. They're essentially on top of each other. And there's a number of factors for that. There's been strong economic growth that has built up or increased the demand side. On the supply side, OPEC and Russia have been cooperating, if you will, in terms of the supply that they put on the market. And there was just some correspondence over the weekend that Russia signaled that they wanted to continue the arrangement, constrained supply, and the Saudis kind of echoed that in the press. And so I think there is an expectation that there will continue to be discipline in terms of production. There is, of course, I think events in the Middle East and what may or may not happen in Iraq are critical factors as well. Moving on to slide 17, you see this in graphical form, where the orange line is the demand or consumption, the blue line is production, and whenever the green falls below the kind of the midpoint there, what that means is that demand is greater than supply, and so there's upward price pressure, and that corresponds to those years of 2013, 2014. And then when the green bars rise above the line, that is a period where the supply is greater than demand and there's a downward price pressure. And of course, that reflects with what we saw in the marketplace. And then you're seeing, as you look forward, more of a balance between those two drivers. In the fall, and this happened in this year on October 9th, we assemble a group of participants in the state. This includes economists from ICER, from the department, legislative finance participates in it, a number of people from the community, and we have experts come and present information about where they see the market going and how they predict and the drivers that underlie the oil price, the potential oil prices moving forward. Out of that, participants will take this P10, the P50, and the P90 percentile path, and provide that to Dan and his team. Looking then to slide 19, this reflects then the analysis from the department taking that information and predicting a set of alternatives, each with their own predictive expectation associated with it. And you see there highlighted that the forecast that is represented, and these are nominal dollars, so this is reflective of what the price will be in that period, and what you see is that essentially the price is largely unchanged for fiscal year 18. 19 is in the neighborhood of $56, and then it grows out, and in 2028 it's close to $80 is kind of the forecast. It's worth noting that in real dollar terms, our predicted forecast would have price rise to about $60 a barrel, and in real terms will stay pretty close to that $60 barrel price over time.
Commissioner, Senator McKinnon, for those following. A previous Senate Finance Committee member asked this question, so I'd just like to attribute that to him. When we are going through this process, why are we not using industry averages that are already compiled elsewhere to use as far as pricing numbers for our forecast?
That's a great question, and I'll show you in a moment that there is no single industry average, and so there's a variety of benchmarks we could choose. And I think what you're going to see is that our forecast is very close in line with those. Each source has, I think, different characteristics that make it valuable and influential. And so let me go a couple slides, and I'll try to respond to that and come back and if I haven't answered it adequately.
Thank you, Commissioner.
So moving to slide 20, this shows, and it's a little bit the meaning of the bars varies a little bit depending on which side of the chart. So on the left-hand side where it's the actuals, the solid black lines actually show the range of pricing during that period, the high and the low, and the gray bar that intersects it has been the average price. As you look forward on the forecast, then the black line represents that P90 and the P10 values, with the gray line representing the average price predicted and the price that is reflected in our model. So here is the first representation of how we compare to others. Well, forgive me, this doesn't include, we don't have our pricing on it. Okay. Oh, yes, thank you. I'm on slide 21. Thank you for reminding me. This is produced by the Energy Information Agency, and what you see there is that they have their prediction, in essence, in red, and then the green represents the New York Mercantile. That's, in essence, the futures market. And so EIA takes those futures market pricing, and the two dotted lines, the high and the low, are 95% confidence intervals. And so they're, in essence, saying there's a 5% chance that oil could be above $80 a barrel by 2019, or could be down closer to $30 a barrel by 2019. And it just kind of gives you a sense of the range. Here, then, it shows our price, which is the dotted black line. The NYMEX price is the futures index. Thank you. I'm on slide 22. I'll try to do better. The blue line represents the analysts, and the green line represents the EIA price, or the Energy Information Agency. And that jump you see in January of 19, in some respects, reflects a stale price. That was they have not updated that since January. While the lower portion of the green line has been updated continuously, most recently in October. And so just a couple of things that I think people would share is that, for example, some might say, well, why don't you just use the NYMEX pricing? That's the futures pricing. People who are betting money, that's what they're betting on. And, I think that as I've spoken to experts, some of the things they've said is that NYMEX price is a strong predictor in the near term. But the further out you go, the less predictive that becomes, the less accurate it becomes. And there's not a very strong correlation between that future pricing and what has actually historically happened. Alternatively, the blue line represents what the analysts predict, and you can see the analysts themselves vary from the futures market, which is kind of an interesting fact, since many of the analysts are also participating in that industry. But nevertheless, you see that vary or that change, and so I think that we're
kind of in a fairly tight range with these other predictive models, and I think that we've generally been relatively well served by our process of forecasting pricing.
Commissioner, when we say EIA, is that a federal agency source, so the Energy Information Agency?
Yes, it is.
Thank you, Ms.
Moving to slide 23, this then shows a comparison. The orange line, the upper line, is the pricing that was present in our spring forecast. And to be clear, as I mentioned, there have been two spring there was a spring forecast and then an alternative scenario. The pricing did not change between those two, and so this pricing was consistent in both of those. And then you can see in the darker blue line or the thicker blue line how that pricing has been revised in the most current exercise. If there aren't questions, I'm going to turn the mic over to Dan Stickle. But if there are any questions before I step away.
Commissioner, Senator Bishop rightfully said if we could take a pause and let you switch mics, it's just easier to have the speaker directly in front of the mic. Brief at ease. Welcome to Senate Finance, Mr. Stickle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Stickle. I'm Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. So I am going to pick up with talking about the remaining two major factors of the petroleum revenue forecast being company costs as well as credits, and then I'll walk through some slides that summarizes our revenue forecast and make some comparisons to the previous forecast. So starting with slide 25, Slide 25 shows the cost forecast for North Slope capital expenditures compared to the previous forecast. We get cost forecasts submitted to us by the operators of the units with a five-year time horizon, twice a year, once in the spring, once in the fall, and that's a main source of our cost forecast information. We also look at plans of development, various public information, things like that. So you see there's been a change in the cost forecast. There's two components to this. For the legacy fields and the existing production, operators, by and large, have reduced their expenditures across the board. They're doing more with less, which is consistent with what you saw in the presentation earlier from the Department of Natural Resources. So that shifted the orange line down quite substantially. And then what you're seeing is also there's a portion where the blue line, which is the new forecast, starts to go above the previous forecast, and that's where we're actually adding in capital expenditures for some of these new fields that are coming online, especially in the 5 to 10 year time horizon.
Mr. Stickle, Senator Von Imhoff, did you have a question? It begs the question on credits that I asked before that I said was an unfair question to DNR. If how many wells or investment in production is happening from a producer or from an explorer, and the DNR side of the house under production is using a five-year window with new variables, how have you taken that into account in trying to provide apples to apples to us in connecting the dots between investment, the credits, and now the difference that we have over on the new scenario on production? Does that make sense? There is a new dynamic happening, and I want to understand how you're interpreting what's happening over in DNR, and then whether credits and the payment of those credits are affecting investment.
Sure, Madam Chair. To address the first question first on how we're coordinating with Department of Natural Resources, we're definitely working closely with them throughout the production forecast process. And when we're incorporating these new fields into the cost forecast, we're actually looking at the chance of occurrence that DNR is assigning to the various fields. So if there's a new development and we think it will cost $1 billion to bring online and DNR is assigning a 20% probability to that, then we'd include $200 million of that development cost into the forecast. As far as the credits side of things goes, there's definitely been a drop-off in spending. We had about $4 billion in capital expenditures on the North Slope in fiscal year 2015. So there's definitely been a drop-off, and when we met with the companies this fall, we really tried to tease out what is driving their changes in behavior. And, you know, we've heard consistently that, yes, state policy is part of it, oil price is part of it. So I think both of those kind of coming together to result in that that cost pressure in the downward direction.
Commissioner, Mr. Stickler, I warned you that I would ask this question. So for those that might be listening, you have had a chance to gather your thoughts, and that is, given that the governor has detailed multiple times a Senate proposal to pay more of those credits, and seeing a reduction that you're showing on this particular slide, I have one very pointed question, and that is, do we owe the credits?
So two things, if I may. First of all, you'll see future slide that, in fact, for a variety of reasons, and this was not a policy decision on the administration's part, but for a variety of reasons, we're actually predicting that credits will be paid off in higher levels and more quickly than perhaps prior forecasts had shown. And so you'll see that, and Dan will go through that information so everybody has that. Secondly, I think the governor, even though he has vetoed twice, he also, when he proposed, I believe, his last budget, did include paying off credits in a faster manner than what the kind of statutory minimum would have been. And so I think that we understand that there's a need to pay those credits, and we look forward to working together with the legislature to find a way to do that quickly and to provide the capital that the producers need to continue to develop and grow the industry.
Commissioner, we have some companies that have went bankrupt. We have some companies that are that their financiers have actually contacted the legislature and individual legislators asking this question. And so if we could have a definitive answer of whether we owe these credits and whether we are going to pay those credits. I understand that we haven't determined the timeline, but if we could get that on the record, again, one individual that I met with, their bankers are asking whether Alaska thinks we owe these credits or not, and so I'd like that very clear that the governor has acknowledged we owe the credits.
Yes, we acknowledge we owe the credits, and I believe the only question is what is the rate at which we're going to pay them off, and that's something we acknowledge we need to work on, and it's something that I believe if we can get through special session and deal with some of the bigger blocks associated with our fiscal, the funding of state government, it gives us an opportunity to deal with some of these other issues like the tax credit.
And lastly, Commissioner, the Senate has proposed paying a third of them this last year, but we weren't able to bring the House along to see the wisdom of our particular way. Maybe this next year the other body will think we should pay more than that. But I'm encouraged to hear that instead of the minimum payment, that we might look towards finding a way to give some certainty for a business that's providing 70% right now of Alaska's revenue to get some of those past bills paid. So thank you for that. Are there questions from committee members? Please continue, Mr. Stickle.
Sir, continuing on again for the record, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. And I will have a few more slides that dive a little bit deeper into this credit issue coming up in a little bit. Moving on to slide 26, this is the rest of the story on lease expenditures. These are the North Slope operating expenditures that we're projecting. This is the ongoing cost to maintain the oil field, employ the people to get the oil out of the ground. And again, there's two stories here. We've seen pretty much across the board from the operators continued pressure on bringing down operating expenditures. They're doing everything they can to make the current price level work on the North Slope. So we've seen in the legacy fields 5 to 10% reductions in the expected operating costs of those fields going forward. And then once you get into the 2022-2023 timeframe, you see a bump up in the expected operating expenditures. And again, that's where we're bringing in the cost of operating some of these new fields that have been added to the forecast. Moving to the credits forecast, we'll move on to slide 28 here. So before we get into the numbers themselves, just a note on the methodology on how we come up with this statutory credits appropriation. So the legislature has phased out a lot of the tax credits that are eligible for state purchase with action both in the 2015 and the 2016 sessions. There's still an outstanding balance for the credits that were accrued, and we still have some credits that are filtering in this year as well as next year. So as far as how to appropriate money to pay off that balance, we do have statutory language that gives some guidance into that. That's in Alaska Statute 43.58, which references the Oil and Gas Tax Credit Fund. And this statute references the revenue from taxes levied under 4355.011, which is a specific part of the production tax code. Interestingly, the credits themselves are levied under are applied under a different section of the tax code. The important piece of information here is the interpretation that we've been using to calculate this statutory appropriation. So we are looking at either 10 or 15% of the value of the tax before application of any credits. So that's basically the 35% net tax before you apply any per taxable barrel credits, and that's what we have been showing for our estimated statutory appropriations. Moving on to slide 29, this actually puts some numbers to what I was just talking about. This is an example of how the production tax is calculated, and then how the statutory appropriation is estimated. This comes from our spring 2017 official forecast. You can see at the time we were estimating a market price of $60 per barrel, about 140 million taxable barrels, and $5.6 billion in costs, which gave us a estimated production tax value of $1.4 billion. When you apply the 35% net tax rate to that, the tax before applying any credits was estimated at $490 million. The statutory multiplier when our price forecast is $60 or above is 10%. So our estimated statutory appropriation for fiscal year 2019 was about $49 million when we came out with the spring forecast. Moving on to slide 30.
Mr. Tagway, I have a question. If it's based on what we're predicting, then the administration is in control of the amount. I mean, these numbers are fairly close this year, hovering just below $60 a barrel. Did that consideration go into any of the conversations that were had at the department in setting the future price production?
Madam Chair, you are correct that the statute specifically references the forecast price by the Department of Revenue, but this provision of the appropriation to the tax credit fund, as far as I'm aware, did not factor into our price forecast whatsoever.
Thank you.
If I can just say, I wasn't here obviously back then, but certainly in the time I've been here, there was no discussion about credits or the value of credits or what might have been paid or not paid as we thought about this, the pricing in this exercise. And in fact, you'll see in a moment that lowering the price forecast had the perhaps counterintuitive result of increasing, because you go from that 10%, if you're $60 and we reduced it, it goes to 15%. And so arguably it actually increased the amount of credit that would be paid. And you'll see that in the next slide.
Right. Continuing on again for the record, Dan Stickle. Moving on to slide 30, this shows the same calculation of fiscal year 2019 production tax and estimated statutory appropriation, but this time we're using the preliminary fall forecast instead of the official spring forecast. So what's happened here is we have decreased our price from $60 to $56 per barrel, our forecast price for fiscal year 19. We've also increased the number of taxable barrels due to the higher production forecast, and the estimated company spending has come down quite a bit. And the net result of all of those is that we now have a estimated production tax value of $3.3 billion for fiscal year 2019. And when you apply the statutory 35% tax rate to that, you get a production tax value, you get a tax before credits of $1.15 billion. And as the commissioner mentioned, since we're below, our forecast is now below $60, the multiplier for determining the statutory appropriation is 15%. So now we have an estimated appropriation of $172.5 million. This is for North Slope. You throw in a little bit for Cook Inlet, and that gets us to $175 million, which is our current estimate for fiscal year 19. So the question was, what changed between spring and fall in terms of going from about $50 million to going to about $175 million for this statutory appropriation? Well, the production forecast increase, looking at slide 31 here, thank you, Madam Chair. So from the spring to the fall, the production forecast increased by about 29 million taxable barrels, which adds, even with the decrease in our price forecast, that adds $800 million more gross value from the oil being produced on the slope. Our cost forecast decreased by about $1.1 billion total. That's a combination of the capital and the operating costs. And therefore, there was $1.9 billion in additional estimated profit on the North Slope. Multiplying that times the 35% tax rate gives us an additional $660 million in tax before credits. And then finally, we went from the 10% to the 15% multiplier. So those are the reasons that the statutory appropriation estimate increased from spring to fall. And under our current preliminary fall forecast, we're looking at greater than $100 million under the statutory appropriation calculation for all years of the forecast. Moving on to slide 32, this put some numbers to what we've been talking about. There's three. This chart shows production tax and compared with before credits against liability, after credits against liability, and then the gray bars on the right for each year are net of repurchase credits by the state. So that shows the net fiscal impact to the state in the given year from the production tax system as a whole. And you can see that, for example, in fiscal year 2019, we're looking at, if you just look at the 35% net rate before applying credits against liability, which are these per taxable barrel credits, that's somewhat misleading because those are an integral part of the tax calculation, but they are technically treated as tax credits, so we break them out as such. But looking at fiscal year 19, for example, there's about $1.2 billion in tax before credits. When you take away those projectable barrel credits, it gets you down to about $300 million. And then there's about $175 million that we're estimating for the statutory appropriation, leaving a net of about $125 million in fiscal year 19.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Is it fair to say that the 35% tax rate in combination with the tax credits per barrel is a mechanism to create slight progressivity in the overall model as far as functioning?
Madam Chair, yes, adding a slightly progressive element was part of the justification in going to the per taxable barrel credit. Another justification was to directly incentivize production as opposed to the previous system, which directly incentivized spending.
Thank you.
Moving on now to slide 33. This is a similar chart to the one I just showed, but this looks at all unrestricted petroleum revenue. So this is also going to include the unrestricted portion of royalty as well as corporate income tax, property tax. You can see that even after accounting for all of the tax credits paid through appropriation, we still get well over $1 billion in unrestricted revenue net from the industry. If you count in the restricted revenues that flow to the permanent fund and school fund, it's about $1.7 billion in fiscal year 19, and then increases in years after that. Slide 34 shows in the blue bars, it shows the outstanding balance of tax credit obligations. And then in the gray bars, it shows the estimated statutory appropriation for fiscal year 19 and beyond, as well as the actual appropriation that was made by the legislature for fiscal year 2017 and fiscal year 2018. And what this chart shows is how the estimated balance of tax credits would change over time under the forecast if this full statutory appropriation is made each year. So legislative action in 2016 and 2017 with House Bill 247 and then House Bill 111 earlier this year phase out the earning of new credits over time. And then we're seeing that balance with the appropriation. Looking at fiscal year 19 as an example, we're estimating $118 million in new credits that will come onto the books. Even though the credits have been phased out, if there's a bit of a delay for the companies to submit their returns and get all their information in, and then for the credits to be reviewed and approved by the department and then on the books. So fiscal year 19, we have $118 million in new credits. We're estimating $175 million paid, which would leave a balance of $679 million at the end of fiscal year 19. Senator Bishop.
Thanks, Mr. Stickle, for doing a great job. You talked about credits under review, and that has to be between two departments, not just your shop, but also the Department of Natural Resources, because they have to read the film to send it over for your approval. Is that correct?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, for certain exploration credits, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. And a follow-up, the question that I had to the previous presenter was if we have actually paid off the credits for those who have provided seismic data that is going to be released. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair, so the appropriation for repurchase of tax credits was sufficient to cover all outstanding tax credits through fiscal year 16. So the answer is most likely. This balance is those credits that became available for repurchase in 2017 and beyond. And so just to conclude on here on slide 34, what this shows is that assuming we make the statutory appropriation as we've calculated it here, that this scenario would potentially pay off the entire balance of outstanding tax credits by fiscal year 2025. I think the appropriation in that final year would be something in the $90 million range, and then these credits would be entirely taken care of.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are you saying with this testimony that it is the intent of the administration just to fund the statutory amount?
Through the chair, if I can respond to that. No, that's not what we're saying. I think we're trying to articulate what the statutory minimum is, and then that conversation, and you'll hear this tomorrow with Director Pitney, we're trying not to make policy decisions at this point in terms of what the governor may or may not choose to do and how he may or may not construct his budget, but rather just to articulate kind of what a steady state budget would be. And in the past, we paid at the statutory minimum, and so that's what we're reflecting here and showing how that has changed as a result of changing facts.
Excellent. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. So that concludes the discussion of the credits that we have put together here. Moving on to how the revenue forecast has changed since we put out our previous our previous forecast. I'll start with slide 36 here. First of all, we want to acknowledge that we missed the forecast for fiscal year 2017 to the tune of about $300 million. And there were two major issues going on there. First of all, about $125 million of that shortfall had to do with adjustments that were made in consultation with legislative finance that have to do with deposits to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So under the Constitution, any revenue as a result of a termination or settlement of an administrative proceeding or litigation goes to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So what happened in fiscal year 17 is Legata came in and identified numerous transactions that were revenue that were received in previous fiscal years and accounted for as general fund revenue that should have gone to the CBRF. So an accounting adjustment was made in fiscal year 17 for those revenues. So it's in terms of cash the state received, we still received the money, but we made an accounting transfer in fiscal 17. That was about $125 million of the shortfall. The remaining $170 million of the mess had to do with corporate income tax, which came in significantly below our forecast, and I'll have a couple of slides diving into more detail on the corporate income tax specifically coming up here in a minute. Some of the highlights to the petroleum revenue forecast and how we've changed that from the spring forecast to the fall forecast. Our oil price forecasts, looking at page 37, thank you, Madam Chair, we have reduced our oil price forecasts slightly from the spring forecast. We're now expecting, as the Commissioner mentioned, oil prices to settle in the $60 real range. We're now looking at oil production to be more stable in the 500,000 barrel a day range generally, which is a change from having a consistent decrease year over year in the previous forecast. So what that has led is it's generally led to an increase in our revenue forecast over the time horizon compared to the official spring forecast in particular. You'll see compared to the alternative scenario, it's actually down a little bit for the next couple of years. And finally, companies have cut costs on lease expenditures. That's a factor. It doesn't flow through to revenue as much given where we are in the price scales for the production tax calculation, as companies are largely paying the gross minimum tax at current levels. But it's definitely something to be aware of looking at the forecast and how that'll feed through to potential revenue and later on and potential production as well. And also, as we go through these, I want to highlight the fact that there is still some uncertainty surrounding the revenue forecasts. When we talk to companies about their investment plans and their future spending and production plans, they highlighted oil price and state policy as the two major uncertainty factors that could impact this forecast going forward. So moving on to slide 38, I'll present.
We have a question. I'm sorry.
Just a comment.
Senator Bishop.
Just a comment back there on page 37, Madam Chair. I don't think you cannot overemphasize that last bullet enough. That bullet in and of itself is one of the most important things in this whole 47-page presentation. And people need to zero in on that and the administration and legislature alike to send the correct signals. Thank you.
Senator Bishop, thank you for those comments. That was part of the reference earlier to the last 4 years of uncertainty and increased taxes on oil and gas through several bills taking away credits that were cashable and some that were not. Thank you, Mr. Sickle. Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Okay, so moving on again on slide 38, offer a comparison showing our revised fall forecast for fiscal year 2018. Showing this in two ways. One is comparing to the 4% decline scenario that we put out towards the end of April of last year, and then another comparing to our official spring forecast. You'll see that for fiscal year 18, our price is unchanged. Production is up from both of the previous forecasts. Costs are down from both of the previous forecasts. And the end result is that we have a slight increase in the forecast versus the official spring forecast, and actually a $70 million decrease in the FY18 forecast versus the 4% decline scenario. And the reason for that decrease has to do entirely with corporate income tax and the fact that we have reduced our forecast for corporate income tax. Moving on to slide 39, this is a similar comparison, but looking at our forecast for fiscal year 2019, which is the budget year that will be before the legislature next session. Again, compared to the previous forecast, production expectations have been increased. Our expectations of oil price and company spending have been decreased. And again, you see that our revenue forecast is a little bit higher than the previous official forecast, and actually a little bit lower than the 4% decline scenario, again, with corporate income tax playing a key part of that reduction. Moving on to slide 41, this is a chart that looks at all revenues to the state, history for 2017, as well as forecast for fiscal years 2018 and 2019. So this includes our unrestricted general fund revenue forecast, which is typically the subject of most of the budget discussions, but then also we point out the designated funds in three different categories that are used in the budget process. So you'll see that unrestricted revenue is expected to rebound from the fiscal year 2017 levels quite a bit. That has to do mostly with the fact that fiscal year 17 was a very low revenue year. I looked back in time, and fiscal year 17 was actually the lowest unrestricted revenue the state has had since at least 1999, which had a similar revenue number in 99. Total revenue decreases from fiscal year 17 a little bit, from about a little over $12 billion to $10.6 billion. And the reason for the decrease in total revenue has to do with expected moderation of investment returns. Primarily in the permanent fund, returned over 12% in fiscal year 2017, which is very good. And the expectations there is that will return to a more historically normal 6 to 7% annual return going forward. Slide 42 then looks again at total revenue, but this time with a 10-year history and a 10-year forecast, looking at all different state revenue sources. What this shows is historically oil revenue was the largest source of revenue in the state. Going forward, it's actually investment revenue. When you look at all funds, regardless of designation, it's actually investment revenue that will be the number one source, followed by federal and then petroleum, and then finally the non-petroleum revenues. Digging in specifically to the unrestricted revenues, we're now on slide 43. First, we'll look at the petroleum unrestricted revenues for fiscal year 17, as well as 18 and 19 forecasts. Royalty is the biggest share of unrestricted petroleum revenues and is expected to continue to provide over half of the petroleum unrestricted revenues going forward. We're expecting modest increases in production tax as price and production are both increasing, and then we're also expecting a bounce back to corporate income tax that has a positive general fund revenue impact to the state. Slide 44 looks at the non-petroleum side of unrestricted revenues. We're expecting that the non-petroleum will account for about a third of the unrestricted revenues going forward. That's becomes a more significant share than it was in the higher oil price years in the back. A couple highlights here on the non-petroleum corporate income tax. FY17 was a lower than expected year on the non-petroleum side as well. We saw kind of a similar trend, and then I think the next slide I'll get into the corporate tax discussion in a little bit more detail. We are expecting that to bounce back in fiscal year 18 and 19.
I have a question for the commissioner. Last year when the budget was introduced by this administration, it included policy determinations yet to be made. And what I'm talking about specifically on this slide is the motor fuel tax. And so before we actually had a policy in place, the administration considered that policy and spent that money. Will the legislature see that again, or will we wait and let the policy discussion lead the conversation versus follow the spending?
Madam Chair, I don't know that I can respond to that. I understand the concern in the question, and I will certainly communicate that as we go through. To be honest, those discussions are happening right now in terms of the policy discussions that will ultimately reflect in the budget, and I don't know that that decision has been made, but I will express your concern.
Senator, I just want to make sure that we're on board, and for those who don't follow the budget, for those Alaskans who are concerned about the size of our operating budget, what the Senate has faced in the last few years is policy decisions being included in the budget, and then they are not implemented by the legislature, and then we have a revenue shortfall or additional spending that somehow is now new state government that, or at least paid for new state government by a policy that the legislature did not agree with. And so I understand the policy discussion, but it's helpful to let the budget reflect actual revenues that are coming in and where those revenues are coming forward from versus the policy incorporated all at the same time. At least that's my perspective in a singular way. Senator Von Imhoff. Okay, press the red button. Okay, is the investment revenue. And, you know, studying historical budgets from the past, investment revenue hasn't always been included with all the other revenue. That's sort of more of a recent phenomenon. It's been included, but not necessarily in the same with the Fed receipts, with restricted revenue, unrestricted, and so forth. There's pros and cons to that. Without really passing a POND or have never really utilized the earnings reserve, this has been off limits. Basically, the investment revenue in the past has only been used to pay dividends or calculate dividends. So what is your comment now on including it in the columns and in the bottom line?
So through the chair, and this is Commissioner Fisher, I will give you one perspective, and Dan may have more of a historical perspective because he's been here through that. But I think that the governor's been fairly transparent for some time that this administration believes that we cannot solve our fiscal challenge without using investment income. And you saw that in the chart that Dan referred to, where investment income has become the largest single source of revenue for the state. It certainly has been our budget has been part of the pro forma budget that OMB released earlier this week. I guess I'm hopeful, maybe a good way of saying it, that there's a appreciation within the legislature that was reflected. I know the SB 26 didn't pass, but it, in one form or another, passed both bodies, both chambers, and the difference was, at least to my way of thinking, was relatively modest between those two bills, and that sits in conference now. And so I guess speaking for myself, my view is that that investment income will need to be part of the ultimate solution.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Von Imhoff, thank you. On the same slide, Mr. Stickle, did you have a comment regarding Senator Von Imhoff?
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle for the record. So looking at slide 41, you'll see we break out revenues into four broad categories. The investment revenue shown under the unrestricted general fund revenue category is a small amount that represents earnings on the available balance of the general fund. It truly is unrestricted revenue. The majority of the investment revenue we're showing as other restricted. That's consistent with past practice. That assumes no shown the entire earnings of the permanent fund as other restricted revenue. And we've talked about this, and the determination is that we are not going to show that as unrestricted revenue in the revenue sources book until the legislature has passed a plan to start using that revenue, should they choose to do so.
Mr. Stickle, if I could, but the courts have interpreted that it is unrestricted revenue, so it's a bit in conflict with how the administration is doing that. For those Alaskans, there's a much longer lawsuit, per se, that has determined that on behalf of the people of Alaska through the court systems. Can you speak to that at all?
Sure, Madam Chair. Yeah, there's various ways that things are shown in the budget process, and we do our best to have the revenue sources book and the way that we present our revenue forecast be consistent with the conventions that are used in the budget process by OMB and Legislative Finance. We actually have an alternative way of looking at the revenue forecast. We call it revenue subject to current year appropriation, and I have a couple slides on that at the end of my comments, and that slide actually looks at all revenue that is technically available for appropriation by the legislature.
Mr. Stickle, thank you for those remarks, which leads me to a follow-up question that I've asked this administration before, and that is there are hundreds of millions of dollars, if not $1 billion worth of tax credits outside of the oil and gas industry that have not been touched. And I'm wondering if this administration will be advancing any policy discussions that would change those particular tax credits. So, for those Alaskans that are listening, in order to obtain additional investment in some cases or additional job opportunities, the state through decades have offered tax credits. That's we've chosen not to receive revenue from different industries so that we could reinvest that into, that money right back into those industries. So if it's mining or fishing or a variety of other places, we have foregone revenue, and they're called tax credits in accounting in the state government budget. And I'm wondering whether this administration will be advancing legislation to change some of those tax credits like they've done in the past with supporting changes in the oil and gas industry.
Madam Chair, at this stage, to be honest, I have not looked at doing that. So I'll be happy to work with you and others in the legislature if there's an interest, but candidly, that's not been a place that I have spent time and energy on yet, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't. It just means that I haven't done so yet.
Commissioner Fisher, they're painful discussions. We have books that have been issued on them out of the last 4 years. We have two different cycles of books that have touched almost every department, and I certainly have scoured those looking for some easy answers. They're not there. The fishing industry certainly is a beneficiary of those tax credits for good reason. It's hard to make money at fishing when most of our licenses are held by out-of-state owners. And so when we talk about tax credits, it's the people of Alaska that tend to get the brunt of our policy discussions. But the benefit, at least the huge benefit, is going to out-of-state ownership interests. And I just wonder when we might take on that. We've taken on the film industry that we thought could benefit from a tax credit, and we eliminated those several years ago. We've eliminated cash credits and other credits that are being extinguished on oil and gas. And so there are other industries that certainly benefit, but they certainly deserve at least a little bit of scrutiny on how much is still off-book that we're providing. And I know that there's a huge interest for seniors and veterans that are included in those tax credit benefits. As an example, we provide seniors who reach the age of 65 hunting and fishing license as long as they remain in the state of Alaska. So those impact individual Alaskans, but there is also a cost to the state to do that because we are still managing those resources. So I just want to make sure the administration is looking at those tax credits as well. Indirect tax expenditure is the report for those that might be listening that are interested in this portion. Indirect tax expenditure from Legislative Finance has those books online. As we have evaluated over the last 4 years of the impact of that foregone revenue. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Stickle. Senator Hoffman.
where we had $16, $17 billion and we needed to take action to try to protect that. Today, you know, it's maybe around $2 billion. But the largest savings account that we have, I think, is the ERA. Do you know what that balance of the ERA is cumulatively today?
To the chair, in our CBR, I think it's about $2.2 billion, and the ERA, I'd have to get the exact number, but it's just up about $13 billion.
And the concern, I think, that Mr. Bishop and others have said, I think, central statement as well, is we have the fund itself, and we need to make sure that the fund is healthy, and we need to use the ERA in the wisest manner possible. And that may be difficult given the magnitude of the deficit that the state of Alaska is facing.
Through the chair, I just want to echo what Senator Hoffman has said. I think that one of the most important decisions that we have to make, both as an administration, as a legislature, is to develop a long-term sustainable draw out of the earnings reserve that, consistent with the way we've treated that fund historically, will be available for generations. And I think that will be a challenge in light of the fiscal gap that we face.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just so those that may be turning 60 years old, like I will be this year, 60 years old is the threshold for a free hunting and fishing license, not 65. So I should have known that. But, again, just to set the record straight, thank you.
Excellent. And, again, for the record, this is Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. Going to return to slide 44 here. This was looking at the unrestricted revenue for fiscal year 17, 18, and 19, specific to the non-petroleum revenue sources. We talked briefly about corporate tax, and then we talked briefly about motor fuel tax. So, yes, beginning at fiscal year 18, we have moved the motor fuel tax from unrestricted general fund to designated general fund. What happened there is there was, following the policy discussions in the last session, legislative finance went and took another look at existing statute, and they made a determination that we have been incorrectly classifying those motor fuel revenues as unrestricted, and so they proposed moving it to designated restricted. OMB was in agreement with that change, and so we have basically just followed that change here in our presentation for consistency purposes. And you know, if there's another, I know we're talking about it internally, and if there's another way that we need to show it, we certainly can. We aren't hiding the revenue by any means. When you look at the detail tables and the revenue forecast, it will still be broken out separately as designated general fund revenue and identified there.
Mr. Stickle, in the conversation that you just had a few moments ago, you talked about consistency, and so this will be inconsistent from the previous year, and also for the general public, then a reduction in UGS spend that could be misinterpreted.
Madam Chair, I understand that. Yes, we will. It's going to show a reduction in unrestricted general fund between 2017 and 2018. We'll include footnotes and narrative explaining the change in the revenue forecast document that we put out. In terms of consistency, we have aimed to be consistent with the documents that will be put forward in the budget process.
Mr. Stickle, can you give the Finance Committee an example, or should we go straight to Legislative Finance to ask what changed in the interpretation or what was compelling to make that change?
Sure. Madam Chair, my understanding is it was a reinterpretation of the existing statute, and there is a document that they provided to us that lays out the justification for that change, and we'll be happy to provide that to the committee.
Thank you. If we could have that as a deliverable, so Senate Finance can take a look at that reinterpretation. I know that there was heartburn, at least from myself. I won't include other senators and a previous tax director's reinterpretation on payment of tax credits, I think it was, and how those qualified. And so we're very interested in the details as to designated and undesignated general fund and how those changes are happening. Thank you.
Absolutely. A couple other items that I wanted to point out on slide 44, mining license tax. Fiscal year 17 was a relatively strong year. We saw a nice jump back up in mining license tax revenue into the $40 million range, as there's been a little bit more profitability in the mining sector, which is good news. And then finally, the investment revenue here. Again, this is just the unrestricted investment revenue on the general fund and other non-segregated balances. What's going on here is the Treasury Division is expecting that over time interest rates will normalize and go back to a more historic level of returns as opposed to the very low rates of return we've had on safe investments over the last couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Commissioner, if you could give the heads up at least to only Director Pitney, who is presenting to us this week, under the reinterpretation of Alaska State statute in regard to the motor fuel tax, it would be helpful to know what it's designated for and how that's going to be accounted for on the spending side of the House for this administration. And if there's a policy decision that needs clarification, I would just say from, again, Senator McKinnon's perspective, the money should be used for the federal match so that we can take the money that taxpayers are providing the state and leveraging that at a 10-to-1 ratio to make sure that we can keep the infrastructure that's being used by Alaskans to the highest and best use possible. So if it's outside of that, we might want to follow up with a private meeting so that I can at least understand more fully the administration's direction.
Yeah, forgive me, just to be on the record, I will make sure that we're prepared to talk about that tomorrow with Director Pitney's here.
So again, for the record, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. Continuing on slide 45, I alluded to this a couple of times, a little bit of detail on the corporate income tax. We did miss the forecast for fiscal year 17 rather significantly. Forecasting corporate income taxes has been a challenge in the changing price environment as oil prices have gone from the over $100 level down to the 30s, and then they've been slowly increasing over the past couple of years. So corporate income taxes are based on a measure of either U.S. or worldwide profitability, and there's various apportionment factors that apportions that net income to Alaska, which is then becomes a tax base for applying the tax rate. We identified three primary reasons for missing the forecast on corporate income taxes. And these numbers that I present here are specific to the petroleum side of corporate income taxes, but there was a similar story to a lesser extent on the non-petroleum side as well. Estimated payments came in lower than expected. We received $95 million of payments in fiscal year 17. We were forecasting a rebound in profitability, and that did not happen as quickly as we had estimated. Finally, next, refunds were higher than expected. Refunds in fiscal year 17 pretty much offset estimated payments entirely. Part of that story had to do with a provision that allows companies that experience a loss to carry that back to up to 2 years of tax returns and refile that. So about a little over $50 million of the refund had to do with these net operating loss carrybacks. We expect that now that prices have stabilized and profitability has stabilized, that these large refunds have largely worked their way through the system. And then, so in terms of the petroleum corporate income tax, that would have left us at about zero for fiscal year 2017 in net. So then the third issue was the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund transfers that took place. This was about $62 million in fiscal year 17. And again, a large part of these had to do with money that was received and realized as general fund in previous years. accounting transfer in fiscal year 17. So when you add those three up, that gave us what appears to be a negative number for fiscal year both 16 and 17. Slide 46 shows in graphical form an illustration of corporate income tax revenues, both for the petroleum side and the general side. And as you can see on the petroleum side, we did receive negative net revenues in fiscal year 16 and 17, but that's really kind of an offset to extra revenue that we received in some of the previous years there. We are expecting that corporate income tax revenue will bounce back to not nearly as high as it was on the petroleum side, but will balance out in this $150 to $200 million a year range for the next couple of years. On the general side, we're forecasting a nice increase to about $150 million in fiscal year 18 on the back of a very strong global economy. And, in fact, on the general side, we received over $40 million in estimated payments for the first quarter of the year. So that forecast is looking pretty good right now. Slide 47 and then 48 will focus on revenue available for current year appropriation. We touched on this briefly before. This is another look at revenue that looks at takes away all of the customary restrictions and budgetary conventions that we use in the rest of the revenue sources book, and looks at how much revenue is technically available for the legislature to appropriate for any purpose. This is something that we started doing a couple of years ago, largely in response to folks from outside the state of Alaska that were looking at our revenue and budget documents and trying to make sense of what the state's ability to meet its obligations was. When you're talking to people in other states or federal or private or rating agencies, for instance, to really give them an idea of how much money the state has that technically can be used to meet its obligations. So slide 48 shows this revenue available for current year appropriation for fiscal year 17, as well as the forecast for 18 and 19. For this presentation, we take all unrestricted revenues, which is what we've been focusing mostly on for the rest of this discussion. We also add that portion of royalties over the 25% constitutional minimum that go to the permit fund. Right now, some leases have a 50% share, some leases have a 25% share. The average going to the permit fund is about 31% of royalties go to the permit fund. So that additional 6% then is considered available for appropriation. Any settlements or earnings on the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, as well as the realized earnings of the permit fund. It should be noted that the realized earnings of the permit fund are a little bit higher than what would be available in a sustainable draw scenario. But all told, that gives us a little over $6 billion a year that is technically available for appropriation by the legislature. Mr. Stickle, that's outside of the federal appropriation? Madam Chair, that's correct. We consider federal appropriations typically have some sort of strings attached to them, specific uses, so we don't consider that available for any purpose.
Mr. Stickle, I'm very familiar with that, but sometimes Alaskans are receiving a somewhat distorted message about the growth in government. And while this administration and the legislative bodies have tried to leverage federal dollars, both in the form of health care aid to some of our residents that are in dire need, but also in a sense our federal highway projects and trying to leverage more money in that direction. And so the general public still sees the budget growing when you take into account federal dollars. Another example might be spending on efficient gain and trying to leverage Pittman-Robertson Fund. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Funds, and as we try to make that leverage with the use of UGF dollars, we bring in more either federal dollars or grant fund money. So making that clear is important so that the people of Alaska understand that we are trying to leverage as much money as possible to fill in the hole of past budgets. Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Commissioner, did you have a comment on that? Thank you. Please continue.
Sure. And at this point, Madam Chair, I'd like to hand it back to the Commissioner for the last couple of slides and some closing.
closing remarks.
Commissioner Fisher. So I've only got a couple of slides. We're on slide 49 in the presentation, and this is just trying to wrap up and provide both to the legislature and to the public a view of how this revenue forecast compares to prior. And so you see there's been some confusion about the official spring forecast and then what we call the 4% decline. And so that top box, you see that the official spring forecast actually had a 12% decline in 18. Then followed, and you can see by, you know, 5, 4, 3, 4, you know, kind of decline over time. The spring forecast, this alternative scenario, declined 4% and then stayed roughly at 4% throughout the period. And so the result of that, as you can appreciate, is that the alternative scenario actually offered more revenue to the state than the official forecast. And that's important to know as we're comparing, particularly since this alternative scenario, the 4% decline scenario, is the one that both OMB and Ledge Finance have been using for most of their modeling, I believe, in the last 6 to 9 months. Going down then, comparing our current forecast against the official forecast, you actually see the current prediction or the current forecast that shows growth in every period. When you go look against the alternative scenario or the 4% decline scenario, in fiscal years 18 and 19, we're actually predicting modest declines in revenue compared to what we had been predicting previously. As you move out, particularly in years 2025, 2026, 2027, then you start to see some meaningful additional revenue, and it's reflected in that we saw that leveling off in the out years. In particular, you see additional meaningful revenue. Moving then, if there are no questions, moving to slide 50, and this is our last slide. Oil pricing is declined. As we mentioned, oil production is increased from prior forecasts and is forecasted to be steady over the period. Petroleum revenue will continue to represent a large percentage of the state's unrestricted revenue for the forecast period, from a high of nearly 75% down to 65%. And then against the spring forecast and the 4% decline scenario, you see, well, particularly against the 4% decline scenario, you see some decreases in fiscal year 18 and 19. Importantly, that while there's good news, there is more revenue, the structural deficits that we have been experiencing will continue at least until late in the 10-year period that we're discussing now. Thank you.
Mr. Stickle, thank you for those comments. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you're the Department of Revenue and the state is pretty much dependent on some of the mindset and everything that goes on, as we look at, as was pointed out on slide 42, where the investment income has done very well, I'm assuming that's partly because the stock market has taken off and is continuing to do well, but there's predicted a correction in this in the near future because it's gone on for a number of years, far longer than anybody had anticipated. Is there a thinking within the Department of Revenue as to what they're going to do when the correction happens so that we're not caught unprepared and don't fall into the same trap that happened several commissioners ago, where a bunch of money was lost because of the lack and the ability to go ahead and transfer at the appropriate time? Through the chair, so this is a very interesting question.
because I think many people agree with your assessment that we're likely to have a market correction. And so one of the things that you'll see tomorrow, I believe, in Director Pitney's presentation are some information about that variability, at least looking historically at what the variability has been and the impact that that can have on the investment revenue that's available to the state, and particularly on the POMB model that has been discussed. I know that Angela Rodell and the Permanent Fund will be here on Wednesday as well, and I expect they may have something to offer on that as well. In terms of the question about, and if I understood your question, which is should we be de-risking our portfolio to anticipate the correction, I believe that if you asked most market experts, they would say that trying to time the market actually is counterproductive, and that even though it seems almost foolish not to make adjustments to your allocations when you're expecting a market correction, in fact, the ability to forecast when that correction will come is so difficult that history would show that those funds that maintain a steady asset allocation through the correction actually perform better than those that attempt to time the market and pull money out of the market and then put money back into the market, because invariably it's impossible to predict when that correction will happen. I hope that's responsive.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question had to do more with, is there a plan in place, not so much the risk of the situation, but is there a plan in place so that, because right now our revenues are so low and and the money available, that we're down in the rocks here.
Thank you. So thank you. Yeah, I mean, yes, what you will see, and this is one of the reasons, I think this is one of the primary reasons why the administration believes that additional revenue is important at this time, and why the governor has proposed the additional tax measure that he has, because we need to diversify our revenue sources. One of the things that some of you may have noticed, and some of your listeners may have noticed, is that Alaska has dramatically more volatility in its state revenue than virtually any other state. Because we rely on these sources of revenue, whether it's commodities like oil and other commodities or investment revenue, that there's a fair amount of volatility in that. And so having this tax revenue as a source of both additional revenue and uncorrelated, non-volatile, and we think that's an important component. The proposal that the governor has put forward for this additional taxes does not completely close the gap. I think there's still work, and many have expressed a desire to see additional cuts to the government, and I think we recognize that there's still work to be done in that regard, and we're looking forward to an engagement on a variety of topics, whether it be health care or other topics that can affect
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Other questions?
No.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, he woke up.
I appreciate a little better understanding of the Constitutional Budget Reserve, the fact that we have borrowed something like $16 billion out of it. At one point, we tried to replace the money dead in the teens. Is that a debt, or is that just money that we can use if we want to? Is that returned? I guess that'd be my question.
Senator Stevens, it is money that's owed. That is why over the course of 2007, I believe, until about 2012, it was during high oil prices that the chairman of the Finance Committee returned the money to the CPR. So it is a continued debt owed. So every one of those withdrawals needs to be returned. What it doesn't say in the state statute is, in interpreting that, is when it has to be repaid. So there's no interest on the money. It's the people's money. It's used for the people. but there is a expected obligation to each legislative body whenever possible to start returning that money back into the CBR, which has a higher threshold, as you know, for access. Does that answer the question?
Well, so it's an obligation, unlike the oil tax credits, which have a schedule, but still the debt that we owe at some point.
That's correct.
Thank you.
With that, I would again like to thank the administration. I know that we had conversations. I appreciate the advanced push to get a preliminary revenue forecast to us. I thank DNR for their presentation as well. Even though the slides, when we were offline, I was chuckling that 50 slides are a bit much to try to compact into an afternoon and have a good discussion on it. But I do appreciate the information. Mr. Stickle, you did a great job in bringing the information to the people of Alaska, and I appreciate that. Commissioner, I appreciate what I consider a concerted effort to talk to the Senate Finance Committee, both in a public setting and individually, to follow up with questions that we have. So I'll look forward to the discussion on the change in interpretation and the other deliverables that we spoke about today. But again, thank you, and the reason this is so important to Alaskans is price plus production typically equals revenue in Alaska's state budget that we can deploy to regions of Alaska that are sometimes in great need. With that, further comments from members, we're adjourned. Actually, I take that back. Tomorrow at 10 a.m., we'll be hearing a budget forecast and fund balance presentation from OMB Director Pat Pitney. That's here at the Anchorage LIO, the second floor. On Wednesday at 10:30 a.m., we'll be hearing a presentation from the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, Angela Rendell. And on Thursday at 10:30 a.m., we plan to hear from Legislative Finance Division Director David Teal. With that, we're adjourned.